Hello, I'm Katie Manning, and you're very lucky because you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Enjoy!
I'm Andrew Walsh, a.k.a. Bat Phantom, from the Operation Pug Podcast, proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Witten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Kier Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning.
Welcome to episode 279 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where the only thing better than a sweet rock collection is a box set of transcendental chant music. I'm Jay.
I'm Haley.
And I'm Kier. This week, we give a deep bow to Jon Pertwee on his exit as the Third Doctor in 1974's Planet of the Spiders. So with a surprise appearance by the Doctor's Time Lord tutor himself, the last non-cameo appearance of Richard Franklin as the as a redeemed Mike Yates, and enough puppeteered arachnids to scare off a hobbit, it's an interesting note to end such an iconic character role. So was it a solid note or a sour note? We dive deeper. Okay. Well, obvious question. Where's everybody as far as how many times it's been seen? Haley, I'm assuming this is your first pass through.
Right.
Although
seen
we
it once.
Did. Okay. But did you watch the Regeneration episode? Because I know we've talked about Regeneration episodes.
I don't think so.
All right. Not even just like the clip of the final couple of minutes.
I don't think so. I don't think I prepared properly for the episode where we talked about Regeneration. So.
Oh, well. 5 points for honesty. Jay, how many times have you gone through Planet of the Spiders?
I thought that I had seen it before, but I have not actually. I had seen the Regeneration clip, or at least a good chunk of the final episode. So I constantly remember that. I'm like, no, I've totally seen it because I can vividly remember that. But no, I haven't actually watched this whole story before.
Okay, cool. Oh, that's great. Well, that's gonna give us a couple of things to sort of bounce off here, because not only is it obviously quite the memorable Regeneration sequence because of the buildup just within that sixth episode. It telegraphs it with a very kind of careful orchestration as far as Holmes' script, but it's also another time where we get to discuss the necessity or non-necessity of a six-episode story. Kind of think I know where we're going to go with this, but Haley, who's on the chopping block as far as trimming the story down, if at all?
Well, I believe there was like a 34-minute chase scene. Maybe we could trim a little bit of that.
No, they needed to have Pertwee chase this guy over land, sea, and air. Literally.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Literally. You didn't even know what got left on the cutting room floor. There was the whole unicycle sequence.
Right.
And then when they chased each other from circus tent to circus tent using cannons.
And there was
it kind of reminded me of the end of Talladega Nights, where like the cars blow up and so then they're just running on foot.
so yeah, from a technical aspect, there were some things in this story that probably could have been left at the wayside. But I think aside from, I'm trying to think this through, aside from the entire episode two chase sequence, and it really was pretty much the entirety of episode two, I think the only other place where I could see some more succinct editing would actually be in the first episode, just to get a setup that we're, you know, okay, we're at this this meditation retreat slash monastery. We're potentially channeling into something that that's a bit nefarious. We don't know who's in the know and who's doing it because they think they're accomplishing something else. The chant sequences alone.
Yeah, I'm probably pretty sure that those totaled a good like 6 minutes over the course of the
right.
story.
Right. So yeah, I think you you get rid of some chanting. The first episode's kind of slow, anyways. Like the pacing's a little painful. So you punch that up by intercutting some chase scene, maybe, and you save yourself a whole episode of story.
Possible. I don't know. I took a lot of personal offense to the way that the meditation retreat was being represented in the first place. I mean, first of all, anybody who is frantically chanting Om Mani Padme Hum, like screaming it at the top of their lungs while they're getting frenetically paced, you're probably not reaching your spiritual center.
Meditate faster. That's the goal.
Yeah. Faster, more intense.
You'll get faster results.
I can get a 30-minute meditation done in 6.5 minutes. I am opening chakras just left and right. They're just clanging open right now. Okay, well, all right. So before we drift too far into negative, some really positive aspects here, I would say, again, have to fall upon our character performances. But how did we feel about Pertwee's last go at the title role?
It really felt like they were pulling out all the stops. I mean, we talked about he got to drive the hover boat. He got to fly the little mini plane. They pulled out the Whomobile again. They really were trying to give him everything he could possibly want. There were fight sequences.
We got another scene of Sarah Jane thinking the doctor's dead.
Mm-hmm. A couple times, yeah.
Him getting to speak in foreign languages.
Mm-hmm.
We also had his introspective moments, which I think are some of the strongest. And we'll make sure that we kind of come back to that too, because that's obviously going to have to lead us into our closing segment. We've had some commentary in recent weeks and in recent rewatches about the relationship between the Third Doctor and Sarah Jane and how much of it really kind of played well on camera versus how much of it might have felt a little stilted or even forced at times. Do you feel that things might have settled a little bit in this particular story with everyone's full working knowledge that this was John's exit?
I mean, they separated him pretty early on.
Mm.
And
it's true.
It didn't seem like they had a whole lot of screen time together.
Right. Poignant moments, beginning, middle, and end. Mm. And then again, yeah, this was a lot of team separation, which actually put our good old buddy Mike Yates back on screen for quite a while.
How long ago did he leave UNIT?
Well, the UNIT departure happened prior to Joe's exit.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. Started. So Sarah Jane had never met him before.
Correct. So this sort of shot at redemption him as he's going out and seeking his own path, his new path, coming out of the ashes of everything that he had done previously and the remorse that he was feeling, I think was actually a solid close to Yates's character. Now, granted, he's not completely done with the program. He does a couple of, Franklin has a couple of cameo appearances in the years that follow, but by no means they are not considered sort of, you know, full character appearances. So this is his exit. I mean, to the point where everybody believes him to be dead until the final moments. He does not have the regeneration clause to tap in. How did we come around on Yates? Do we feel that he's kind of genuine and he's sort of found his better path?
Yeah. It's at this point in the story, it's difficult, you know, trying to separate myself from what I know happens later on in the audios and things like that.
Sure.
It seems like he genuinely feels like, you know what, I messed up. I'm never going to get back into UNIT and be where I was there, but I can still do some good. I'm still trying to prove to these people that I worked with and respected that, you know, I'm still out for, you know, doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. So on a number of levels too. I got to imagine that to a certain degree, some of that cognizance has to do with his interaction with Joe. I think Joe really kind of impressed upon him the fact that there's more to just the job. There's the morality behind the job.
Mm-hmm.
So even if he's not wearing the uniform, there's still the idea of serving the good of the individuals around him. Even if it's not on the scale that he would have been accustomed to, if he was still part of UNIT, he can still do something for his fellow human right next to him. I was interested, though, because I started out, and I remember this back in the initial viewing of some of the cultural representation in here. Obviously, our Tibetan representation and things, Kanpo, and how that tends to get presented, and the fact that we've got Kanpo being played by George Cormack, not exactly, you know, Nepalese or Tibetan by nature, anything like that. But there were some aspects of this story where I didn't know whether I wanted to see it explored much further, and a lot of that really had to do with the characters on Metabilis 3. That was, to me, either I didn't know whether I felt it was underutilized and could have been more prominent in the story, or whether it was something that really could have been just sort of written off quickly, but they lingered a little too long. It was kind of one or the other.
Yeah. I think that's right. Like, either it should have been brought in sooner and more woven into the story all along, or we should have gotten done with it faster.
Okay. Because I was expecting them to be more prominent in the final overthrow of the A-Legs. Mm-hmm. Or at least, you know, getting some sort of advantage by the time we close the story. But with the exception of the explosion of the mountain and the Great One going down, I don't really know.
Really, the people didn't do anything. The people on that planet didn't do anything to serve the story.
Right. Yeah. They just maintained.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How did we do with regards to typically when we've got a strong Pertwee story, we're going to incorporate a couple of aspects. We've referred to them. Okay, there's going to be use of various contraptions, vehicles. Okay, there's going to be a bit of invention, some craftiness. There's going to be some fighting that has to happen. Occasionally, there's going to be his opportunity to be able to speak in a foreign language. Sure, always great. But one thing that's also in there is you tend to have this smattering of humor. His icebreaker sort of persona, where he tries to sort of take the piss out of things to calm people down a bit. Did anybody feel that was missing a little bit? Almost as if he knew at this point that the light was blinking for the final episode, and he went through this one with a certain degree of melancholy.
Maybe to a certain extent. It wasn't really something I was paying too much attention to, I guess. Although I definitely knew that the end was coming, and I think that was primarily my motivation for finishing all six episodes as quickly as I did, because I was like, well, I know where this leads. If I hadn't known it was a regeneration episode, I don't know if I'd have been able to power through it the way I did. But
well, that's actually a really good question. Let me pause you for just a second there, because that's actually an interesting point. Had this not been a regeneration episode, how strong, or not a regeneration story, how strong of a story would you really consider this to be? And I know we'll get to this when we talk about rewatchability and recommendations and so forth. But really, I mean, as far as a Pertwee story goes, how did this do?
That's a good summary.
It's a firm, eh?
I mean, there's really no. Okay, so you have mind controlling spiders. You have a planet, and you know where the minority is in revolt, which we've seen so many times.
About a third of the time. Yep.
This one's not even well done, so yeah. It's just kind of. Meh.
There's nuggets of a good story in there, but I don't think they're all developed.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was much better executed in Turn Left.
I mean, I can totally see where back in the, like when this first aired, having these giant animatronic spiders that would have been a shocking visual.
Were they animatronic or were they just puppets?
Well, they were puppets.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I can see where that would have gotten some people freaked out. But nowadays, it's just, yeah, it didn't hold up well.
Mm. Well, yeah, well, that being what it was. I mean, there was that. There was obviously the green screening, the Humobile leaves the surface of the Earth.
Yeah.
It is not. I say we've had a series 11 or season 11 is a bit rocky on a number of counts. And I know a number of people who are devout Pertwee fans who say, you know what, this was not how we wanted to see John go. Whether you want to put the finger on Katie Manning's exit and the fact that a lot of the chemistry felt like it, you know, kind of the wind went out of the sails a little bit, or whether with Delgado's departure or his loss, that that we didn't have the same sort of every once in a while that kind of, you know, I needed a really well-developed baddie to counter for a little while. So we kind of clunked around with a few. You could point at a lot of things, but I think there are some redeeming aspects of this particular story. And a lot of it really has to do with subtext. And that subtext stands out more if you already know, if you're cognizant of the fact that this is going to his swan song, which isn't really much of a swan song. But if you sort of give it that light, some of the things, a lot of his statements, a lot of things that they write into the character have that much more poignancy. Like, he's always been dropping that story about the man in the mountain, the old man in the mountain. He did it with Joe. He did it again with Sarah Jane. This kept coming up over and over again. And we finally get some closure on. We get to meet who the tutor was.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of deftly handled. The hidden mentor all along who's been sending out a physical manifestation to interact with people while the true form sits in an aging body, worn a bit thin.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like it was nice to finally get that payoff, but at the same time, it wasn't something that was so that was such a big part of it that it couldn't have. And I couldn't have ignored not getting it. It almost just felt like they had to cram it in so that they could close that reference. It didn't really do anything to serve the story so much.
You don't think so? I mean, I look at it this way. I see it as, all right, it gives a little bit more of dimension to the Time Lords, because we really have to spell out regeneration for Sarah Jane. They literally just telegraph the entire thing. They start to give some great allusion to the fact that this is a bit of a force regeneration. It's got a bit of a push from a Time Lord who probably, I would assume, is relatively late in their cycle. And he's sort of, he's got a lot of that sort of Zen aspect to him. So he actually, I find it really interesting, the fact that the face he regenerates into is the projection face that he had been putting out there all prior.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually gets to choose exactly how he wants to appear. Like he had been wearing that, you know, in essence for who knows how long prior. So that's a hell of a lot of control. So he's like a Time Lord who's got that whole process down on lock, to the point where he could then can help give a nudge to another ailing Time Lord. I mean, this is leaps and bounds as far as character development for what this alien race is capable of doing. But I do like the fact that they don't credit Tom Baker as the next Doctor the way we expect it to be done now. He mentions that the fact that he's giving the push is going to mess with his mind a bit.
Yeah.
He's going to be a bit mad. Hey, sign me up. I'm all for it.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as like the story goes, it was outside of the like, let's throw out the explanation for regeneration for. But I mean, because there were a lot of new viewers that came in with Pertwee. Mm-hmm. So it was almost one of those things where they're like, well, a lot of these people don't know what happened with first two. Let's explain it to the audience as well.
And I don't think they'd used the term regeneration before to define what's going on either.
By name? You know what? I'm not entirely sure.
Because the first Doctor just said that it was a rejuvenation. Did the Time Lords say that they were forcing the second Doctor?
I think I remember the word change a lot. I don't think I remember the word regeneration being used.
Yeah, we'll have to dig. We're gonna throw the someone clause out there. Someone out there is gonna tell us exactly what it is, because I'm too tired to look.
but beyond all that, like, really, the only purpose that character served outside of, you know, saying regeneration was, you know, he gave the Doctor that little bit of like, it's like, oh no, you did the bad thing. Now go fix it. Which, I mean, you easily could have had the Brig do that. Just, you know, make some offhanded comment that the Doctor put some thought into and decides to run with.
I think if Campo hadn't been in the episode, there would not have been a Campo shaped hole.
Yeah, there you go. That's the best way to say it.
Okay. I suppose so. I don't know. I sort of look at it as this sort of closes the action Doctor sequence, because he had been everything just, you know, a full tilt for seasons. And finally has this opportunity where he's starting to realize the not the error of his ways, but more the danger of the way that he's walking this path, you know, and it's that remorse, as he says, you know, this is my quest for knowledge and information was my own pride, or, you know, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it's kind of that, that realization that he had been a little bit too bold in these things, sort of seeing himself as nearly impervious or nearly impenetrable to the dangers around him because he had successfully been through so many scrapes. And this was a reality check for him. And that sort of gave me the understanding for the latter three, the back half of the three episodes, of why he started really wearing so much on his sleeve and really looking very downtrodden as we draw to the close. Obviously, as he's being controlled by the Grey One, realizing that he's actually manipulable, which was shocking to see. I mean, when he's under mind control, you're like, wow,
yeah.
She's got to have some incredible strength from the amplification of the Manabilis crystals if she could force the Doctor to frog march around the room and such. I think there was a genuine path. Was it really deftly executed? Could have been a little bit tighter or phrased a little bit differently to be truer to the character? Sure. I mean, everything can be improved on subsequent edits, but I was okay with it.
I kind of wish that as action-y as this Doctor had been, his departure had been able to reflect that, you know, a little go more on punch on his way out.
Go down in a blaze of glory.
Yeah.
They found his glass jaw. Possibly.
You know, at the same time, though, it was kind of nice that, you know, his, because you expected him to go out guns blazing, but this was like he was quietly, he was quietly going to his doom, knowing that that's what he was doing. And all it took was him just facing an enemy and essentially losing. You know, he gave up the crystal. He didn't fight the Great One. He didn't do anything to stop her. He just, it's like, oh, this is what you want. Okay, take the thing that you want. And so it was a quiet acquiescence that we hadn't seen from the Third Doctor before. And I think that was kind of poetic.
True. I guess I kind of wondered how they never explicitly mentioned the fact that he was cognizant of the fact that she had no way to vent the feedback on it. You know, going into this, like, so he was sort of discovering this as he was discussing with her. He was ready to just let this all collapse in the hopes. Like, I don't really know if there was a plan there or whether the plan presented itself as he stood there listening to her pontificate and cackle at him that it was all going to dissolve. I mean, did I miss something? I mean, I've probably seen the story maybe about three times now. Like, did I miss
something? He recognized it once he was there, once he saw what was going on. But I mean, at that point, he had already, I think it was before she got the crystal from him. But no, I mean, he was already there in the chamber ready to, you know, ready to give
it all go.
Yeah. And that's when he realized, oh, wait, no, you're biting off more than you can chew here.
Mm. Well, it's a humbling point.
Mm-hmm.
For the Third Doctor, which I think is pretty significant. How that ties into, you know, when we like to look at things in retrospect and say, okay, casting changes as they're going from doctor to doctor, then the persona changes that go along with those casting decisions usually have something to do with, you know, you can find some way to be able to look at that and say, and frame it within, okay, this doctor lived this life. And at the close of that, they learned these lessons as a result of that experience, which causes a bit of a steering correction going into the next doctor. So Haley doesn't have a whole lot of frame of reference to be able to go into the Baker era here, but Jay, I'm going to ask you to do a little crystal balling here and kind of tell me, what do you think were the regrets or the ramifications of the Third Doctor's tact that said, okay, we need to go Baker crazy for at least the next season?
I think it was like the Third Doctor had this penchant for always wanting to be in control, or at least appearing to be in control. And, you know, he always wanted everyone to think that he was cool, calm, and collected, that he was on top of it. And even when things were spinning wildly out of control, he's sitting there like, yeah, no, this is exactly what I'm planning. Just give me time and everything will work out, you know. And leading into Baker, it's more of just the, you know, I have no idea how this is going to work out. Let's go poke it with a stick.
Yeah. chaos theory. Mm-hmm. All right. That's fair. All right. Well, then we look at our rewatchability and recommendability. Now, I kind of have a feeling I know what you're both going to do with this story, but I'm going to let you do it anyway. Haley?
I mean, it's a regeneration episode, so it's important to see once.
You say episode, not story.
Well, I couldn't imagine watching just the sixth part, but...
Really? You don't think that you could probably just stumble through it? If you came into it and you only saw episode six, which, by the way, backs up like a full 5 or 6 minutes into episode five. So there's really only about 15 minutes of new content.
Again, you can... A lot of fat to be trimmed. Like I say all the time, six episode stories should always be four episode stories. I would watch the whole story. I wouldn't just watch part six. But I can't really see the need to rewatch it beyond maybe the sixth part to get the regeneration.
I'll tell you why you need to watch it. Fluffy Brigadier. Brigadier on a holiday. Hasn't gotten a haircut probably about 6 months. He's going full Capaldi.
Yeah. His almost like instant interest in the Turkish dancer or whatever in the first book. He's like oh, I'm going to walk out. Oh, wait, what? Let me pay attention now.
To incorporate that into my exercises for my soldiers.
Yeah.
All right, Jay, what about you?
You know, you have to be willing to rewatch it if you're going to be doing any kind of rewatch. Just it's a regeneration episode, story. So you kind of have to include it just out of, I don't know, almost out of a sense of duty. But as a story in and of itself, once you've seen it, you've pretty much seen it. It's not... There's not really a whole lot to dig out of this one, I don't think. I mean, maybe if you're trying to really get into the Third Doctor and what makes him tick and or how the story wraps up or whatever, maybe. But on the whole, I think the only really enjoyable parts of the story were the one-liners from the brig.
It's true.
But recommendability, I mean, yeah, it's you have to watch it because you have to see how the Third Doctor ends. But
yes. I will say that there's also one other aspect of the story that, as far as carryover, that I would consider to be kind of required, and that's Sarah Jane's role as the bridge mm-hmm. between doctorations, because this is one of those few instances where the companion is going to stay constant through a doctor's regeneration and is going to have to witness it, having only just recently been told how this whole thing shakes out.
Well,
so
only recently having met the doctor.
Yeah. Yeah. Starting to get endeared to them and then having to deal with that transition and still wondering, is this really the same person when they're so inherently different? Really solidifies a companion for the audience because they're the only source of constancy.
Right.
So, okay. Well, I would definitely put it on the recommendation list for all the reasons listed, and just because, you know, you're not going to tell me that I shouldn't watch a Sarah Jane episode or story, so the hell with that. And plus, Whomobile in space, I want it off the ground all the time. Just hovercraft. Just I don't. Yeah, fine. Yeah, trike. Whatever you want to put.
If you can watch it on a little, you know, like 7-inch 4x3 CRT TV, preferably in black and white and fuzzy, it's gonna look brilliant.
It's gonna keep you up at night. Haunting spider. All right, I say we do some news.
Yes, please.
We're gonna need to be frugal about this because we got a lot of news items. We didn't obviously get a chance to cover any of these items when we were at Regen because we were busy /drunk /overtired. So we'll just kind of tear through these, but it's some good stuff. So if some of you are familiar with these news points before, just hush. Let other people enjoy.
Yeah, we're not listening to you. You're listening to us. Ha.
There was a bit of a buzz all through that weekend, actually, about the fact that Moffat had actually made good on his promise to release a little bit of information about what the Eccleston version of the Day of the Doctor script would have really looked like. And everybody got all really excited. And then they published in the Radio Times. And then you realize that it really wasn't terribly different.
Yeah.
Yep.
But, I mean, put aside the fact that it would have meant that we would never have had John freaking Hurt. If you put that aside for just a second, would you, could you have pictured all the scenes with the moment and so forth as exchanges with the Ninth Doctor? Would that have registered, sort of rung the true the same way with yes. Rose standing there?
Yeah. No, I mean, because he would have seen Rose, you know, he wouldn't have recognized that this is the weapon that the Time Lord created. It would have been Rose to him, and it would have made the interaction.
No, this is nine before that happened.
Well, it
before he meets her.
Okay.
Yeah. That's
that brings up the problem of, okay, one thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, we had that in the first episode of the new series, the Doctor looking in the mirror. And clearly, like, this is the first time he's seeing this face.
Mm-hmm.
So it, yeah, that would kind of get.
Well, that I mean, that's also a problem in an episode later that season, because there's these images of him all throughout history alone without Rose.
Well, but he leaves Rose and then he comes back for her. So yeah. He easily could have gone and done those things and been like, you know what? I really do need a companion. Going back to that exact point.
Yeah. True.
Possible.
It's true. All right.
Or he just never looked in a mirror before then.
That's possible, too.
Well, that's going to be tough because they were saying that they were going to drop a lot of ear jokes in the script. So it wouldn't have had the same impact had he not known what he looked like.
That would have been funny. Like, they keep talking about his ears, and he's like, what? What's up with my ears?
I don't like their... My mom says they're perfectly proportioned. All right. Also discussed a bit at Regeneration Who, but not because of things that were going around the news, but because it was actually discussed at Regen, was Capaldi just casually mentioning that he had a script idea that he really wished they ran with. And the Capaldi audience...
had an idea for the show? No.
Yeah.
He wasn't opinionated like that.
You needed to hear the audible gasp when he mentioned who he thought the Doctor should have met, because it made so much sense. You thought, oh, maybe he wanted to, you know, have a cameo appearance by Stephen Hawking, or maybe he wanted to actually have, you know, Professor Brian Cox on there. Oh, how funny would that have been? Ha, ha, ha. No, Jimi freaking Hendrix. And the audience just went, you almost heard them all just nod their head and go, yes.
Yep, that should have happened.
Yep,
and true. would Jimi Hendrix have been hanging out with Katie Manning at the time?
Yes. Yeah. He would have seen Joe on a date with Jimmy. Oh, my God. Everything is just coming full circle now. But he had it all worked out perfectly. You know, the Doctor was a crap guitarist. You know, it's like trying to give Jimmy pointers. Telling him, no, you got to make a wah, 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 wah. Telling him how he's going to build a wah, wah pedal out of, you know, basically like Third Doctor kludged together. Here's a shoebox and a thing. And it was brilliant. And he just kept running with it.
And Jimmy actually teaches the Doctor how to play guitar.
Just let him go. It was brilliant. It was a great one. Where do we want to go from here? God, there's just so much to tackle this week. Okay, let's put our spoiler cone on for just a minute. If you do not want to know the big, not really big, spoilers about what has been divulged about Series 11, give yourself 45, 60 seconds. We're not going to talk about this one. But in case you're curious, I mean, all we know at this point about our upcoming companions, or I should say recurring characters, is who the actors are playing the roles and the names that they've been given. But Sharon Clark spoke out on a Radio 4 program and just let one piece of information go. But thanks to the Metro, they decided to give it a lead line that said that it was major spoilers. But it wasn't real.
Just because they don't have any Doctor Who news to publish it right now.
Because Chibnall's doing a fantastic job of keeping it all on lockdown, yeah. With the exception of the occasional actor who gets a little uppity and says, oh, I'm on there too, like Lee Mack. I've got a little bit role. But yeah, so she's a human character, which means that since she's playing the spouse of Bradley Walsh's character, so we've got two humans, and that's as much as we're getting.
Yeah,
so... Okay, there you go. Oh, and she's very pleased with working on the production. And Jodie is delightful. So,
of course,
no spoilers there. Nothing to add. An interesting little piece. I have a theory about this. If you remember back, speaking of Day of the Doctor, around the time the 50th anniversary was happening, they published this omnibus, this compendium of all of these short stories.
11 Doctors, 11 stories.
11 Doctors. And then they said, oh, crap, we cast 12th Doctor. Let's go back and add another story. So they did. Well, apparently they've set a trend.
Yeah.
So they're going to update it again. But we don't know who is writing for Jodie Whittaker's 13th Doctor.
You know, we still have not gotten a story from J.K. Rowling. Just throwing it out there.
Okay. So you can put your quarter down on that one. I'm wondering whether this is the big, very big, big capital B-I-G big project that Jenny Colgan has been hinting about. Because I think that would be exceptional because of her affinity for Jodie. I think it works. It's her knowledge of the universe, that she's due for this sort of thing. She's really excited about this project she's working on that she can't talk about. But my concern is this going to be published before or after we actually see what her doctor's persona is really like? Because that's going to be impossible to write for. Is she Baker crazy? Is she Colin Baker snarky?
Yeah, maybe it's going to be her working through each of the previous Doctor's iterations and being like, let me try this personality on for size and see how that works. And then at the very end, it's just something like, oh, no, I figured it out. This is how it's going to be. And then it drops it right there.
That's got to be immensely difficult.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to sort of see what more I can find out about this, about the sequencing of this sort of a publication, because I can't imagine the pressure on a writer like that to say, all right, we want you to establish, by canon, establish this doctor's persona before she's had a chance to speak more than two lines on screen. No pressure. I'm still holding up. My quarter's on Jenny Cole. Haley, do you have a dog in this race at all?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Can we all just agree, though, that whoever it is that they get to write this, it needs to be a female author?
By all means. Of course. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Can
all
you, right. The outrage of having the first time that we see anything from the female doctor.
Yeah. It's written by some bloke from Chiswick. okay. I'm going to throw this out there just to sort of muddy the waters a little bit. You can take what you want from it, but, you know, as long as it's not coming from Ian Levine, I'll probably give it at least a little bit of credence. And that's that Philip Morris is still, believing that there are more lost episodes to be found. And he's kind of leading to the belief that, we're looking at something like Evil of the Daleks. Or Web of Fear episode 3.
He said that I think Evil of the Daleks would be a nice find. He's not hinting at like having any clue as to what he's searching for right now.
That's a hint. That's a Morris hint. I don't know. I would not. It may not be immediate. I mean, we may be looking 2 years away from the next episode being announced as discovered. But this could be something where it's actually already been recovered and now they're trying to do a lot of clandestine recovery.
Well, I think the most likely thing would be the episode 3 from Web of Fear, because he actually, like, they did find it.
It was physically in his hands.
It was just lost en route. So, like, we had it for about, like, 26 seconds and then So.
FedEx says it was left on the doorstep.
it fell down in that gap between the elevator and the...
No.
Have you checked under the doormat?
The couch cushions? Anybody look there?
In case you're wondering, it's always in Camden, New Jersey. All right. And the last little piece of feel-good to leave you with is the fact that, well, if you don't buy into the fact that Daily Mail just had a picture fest with this, where they were describing everything down to the trainers that David Tennant was wearing in infinite detail, we had a nice outing where Peter Capaldi and David Tennant were able to share a few photo ops as they went to a screening of a comedy together that... that they both had a vested interest in. So got a chance to see the two of them share a little bit of space together. Georgia Moffat was there. Her son, David's adopted son, was there as well. Just all freaking disgustingly beautiful people. And you get to see 10 meet 12. And Tennant still looks fantastic as he's coming off the set of working on Good Omens. Capaldi looks exactly like we just saw about a week ago. Bit of a scruff beard. I'm kind of digging the scruffy beard. Yeah? Yeah?
And he looks a little ginger.
It's true. So yeah, I think that was a nice little positive to leave on. Oh, by the way, and the screening for the production itself looks really positive too for you, me, and him. Interesting storyline. Check out the film and the opportunity to pursue it. So there you go. What the heck are we doing next week?
So next week, Kier, you had a chance to talk with David Howe from the Doctor Who Memorabilia Museum.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I got a chance to speak with him a couple of weeks ago. So in my head, it's long in the past, but we're gonna give you an opportunity to hear from David J. Howe, writer, historian, writing for Telos Towers Publications, who is opening up this memorabilia museum using a lot of his own personal collection. Interesting stuff. So it's kind of a labor of love. It's a lot of labor. He's out there like pouring floors and building walls and stuff. But because he wants it done right. So we'll have that interview next week.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been episode 279 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, who put Tommy under the stairs? Do you want wizards? That's how you get wizards.
Oh, we totally left out Tommy. Yeah. Oof. Okay. And this is Kier saying, where there's life, there's hope. Finish the quote.
And this is Haley saying, why spiders? Why couldn't it be follow the butterflies?
Planet of the butterflies.
Two Harry Potter quotes.
Yeah. I know.
We'll see you guys next week.
We'll see.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.